Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Carrie Young in for Tiziana Deering. I'm going to start the show with a big question. What is the easiest way to get into an Ivy League school? Well, a new study from top data analysts suggests the answer is simple. Be extremely rich. Joining us to discuss this and to dive into some of the data from the new study is Natasha Wariku. She's a sociologist at Tufts University and the author of the book, Is Affirmative Action Fair? Hi, Natasha. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I want to start off by setting the table a little bit. This research came from some Harvard researchers, including Raj Chetty, who's widely considered to be one of the top economists in the country. And some of the data just is really breathtaking and some of the patterns that we see in it. And the breathtaking data especially correlates to categories like extracurricular ratings, personal ratings, these like non-academic scores in admissions, like what admissions officers are giving to applicants. And so can you first start off by like giving us a baseline of understanding of like, what are these scores? Why are they used or why do they even exist?
Sure. So when colleges, selective colleges are admitting students, they're looking at a whole range of factors. So they want to, they're obviously, they have an academic rating, you know, that's based on certainly your GPA. They're looking at what AP classes did you take. They might also, if you've submitted your SAT score, they look at your SAT. Of course, colleges are increasingly SAT optional. But they're also looking at other factors. So your extracurriculars, right? Because this is holistic admissions and they want students with a broad range of skills, of interests. And so they're looking at, did you play a sport or were you in the orchestra? Were you captain of your team? Did you take on a leadership position? Did you start a new club in your high school? So these kinds of extracurriculars, did you show excellence and kind of long-term commitment to a particular skill that's maybe doesn't show up in your academics. So it's another opportunity for students to show that they have done something commendable beyond the academics. And then there's usually like a third kind of what came up in the Harvard trial as the quote-unquote personal rating, right? And this is just, again, trying to capture a person's lived experience. Did you overcome obstacles? Do you demonstrate grit? Have you taken on unusual amount of responsibility in your home? So these kinds of more subjective qualities, but that they think are important and to be kind of rewarded in the admissions process.
Right. Yeah. That personal rating, I feel like, in looking at this study and then also sitting in on the Harvard trial initially, it came up a lot because it's this really subjective measure. And while we did learn a lot from the Harvard trial about how elite college admissions works, this study really reveals quite a bit more. It's really remarkable how much data they got. Speaking of the numbers, we're going to dive into a little bit more, and especially some of the correlations that it highlights. So I think when I was thumbing through this study, you notice these patterns or the graphs. They look kind of like hockey sticks. Mm-hmm. The data stays pretty, even keel through most of the different income bases. And then you get to the 99th percentile, less than one percentile even. And it just, those scores just shoot up. And so that's the best I can do describing it, in a visual way. You kind of just have to see it. But as someone else who saw this study, what's your reaction to that?
So what that data is showing is they're comparing students with the same SAT score, because this data is from a time when everybody was required to submit their SAT score. So comparing kind of like for like students with the same SAT score and their probability of getting in. Now, I should say that graph probably masks the inequality, because we know that SAT scores are highly correlated with your household income, right? So this is sort of beyond that already source of inequality. And we see that, you might be from a low-income family and have a high SAT score, which is pretty unusual because you don't have access to the same quality of schools or, extracurriculars or SAT prep. but as someone in the 90th or especially the 99th percentile, but that person is much more likely to get in. And what they found was that and then they tried to dig in a little bit more and say, well, what makes those people different from the people who are, you know, below the 90th percentile in terms of their household income? And what they found was kind of three big factors. One is whether they were a legacy applicant, that is, did one of their parents go to the university? Were they a recruited athlete? And then their kind of their extracurricular, kind of more subjective ratings. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that that does really give a good explanation of, you know, some of what they were looking at. But I wanted to highlight, too, like when you look at I think the reason, like I pointed out, like it was the 99th, even less than that one percentile at the top. One thing I found that was interesting with all of this is it kind of dips down. Like when it comes to SAT scores, it's really even until you get to like maybe upper middle class, even pretty wealthy.
Yeah.
And then it shoots back up once you get to that less than 1%. Is that something that struck you too?
I did see that. And I think what is explaining that is that you have two, first of all, these colleges, you know, are filled with children of upper middle class families. So let's just be clear that there is no access issue. I think for the most part, maybe as you get further down closer to the 50th percentile, yes. But I think what you're seeing is that there are so few people who are from low income families who have high SAT scores that gives them a little bit of a bump. So the admissions officer is recognizing that this person is pretty unique, and that they're getting in. Whereas the people who are, you know, say from the 60th to 90th percentile, a lot of young people, it's much more common to have high SAT scores, in part because you are getting SAT prep. Again, the academic rigor of your high school is probably stronger. And that's what, so there's, you know, there's a little bit of a, you don't stand out as much. And then when we get to that top 1%, you know, I'm not going to defend this, but I'm just trying to explain like what's happening. Because I don't think that these colleges want to be doing this, I do believe that they have a value in equity and access, but what is happening? It's the criteria that they're using, right? So the legacy kind of boost. Part, you know, the colleges say, I think that a legacy is on its way out. Let's just be clear. There's the investigation by, you know, the federal government.
Seeing more and more colleges just voluntarily dropping in.
Yeah, I think they realize it's a stain on their, you know, their public image. It just, you know, and what are they getting out of it? You know, I think this idea that maybe those people will be more likely to donate to the university, we don't even know if that's true. But certainly it's money. And I think money plays a big role in all of this that we shouldn't overlook, right? These colleges are the financial model, even at at places like the Ivy League that have, you know, are well endowed. Their financial model is such that they are still, a lot of their expenses are through tuition, right?
Right.
And tuition plus room and board is well over the median household income in this country. So how do you make those numbers fit? Well, you have to have a certain number of high-paying, full-pay students, and you need to have donors, right? And donors are going to donate in part because they feel like it helps their kid get in, right? And that's part of that equation. And then the athletics, there's a long history.
I was just going to ask about the athletes.
Yeah.
How does wealth correlate there?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes when people think about athletic recruiting, they think about the basketball player from an urban neighborhood who maybe comes from a low-income family. And certainly there are some of those young people. But the vast majority of athletic recruits are coming from these very wealthy families. And I'll explain why. You know, for every basketball player, you have someone on the crew team. You have someone on the sailing team. You have water polo. You have these sports that, you know, many young people in this country don't even know exist.
Kind
of expensive. And even in sports that are, you know, that may be more commonly played, like baseball or tennis, or that there is still a growing industry of kind of sport, like private sports development, right? And so you no longer just, you know, play for your town league and then play for your high school team. And when the season's over, you go to the next sport if you're super athletic. Now it's you kind of specialize. You join a kind of private club team that have paid coaches. You're going to tournaments all around the region. And, you know, when in my research in my book, Race at the Top, I talk to parents about some of these club teams, and they can be sports like soccer, basketball, like sports that are accessible. But when you're competing with peers who are playing the sport year-round, I met a young man who had a private pitching coach in high school who wanted to get recruited to be a pitcher at a college. It's hard to compete with that.
There's still a benefit to having that extra funding.
And you're going to programs. You're going to camps where you're going to be looked at by college coaches. These recruiting camps, your parents have to send you there. You have to pay for a hotel. Sometimes they have to go the time to go with you to all these practices. And so that is a way that it is very hard to compete when that's what it takes to get recruited.
Right.
And then there. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I want to make sure we have time to get to a question that we've all been talking about on the Radio Boston team a lot as. Why does this matter? Like, why does it matter that one went to a prestigious Ivy League school, a highly selective school? I mean, I think in the before times at WBUR, I sat next to someone who was a graduate of Harvard, and I went to Clemson, and we have the same jobs. Yep. And so it just kind of, I was like, well, for us, we had similar outcomes, but does it matter? Is it like a social mobility thing? Is it a larger decision maker kind of importance? Can you kind of dig into that a little bit?
Well, I think people often think it matters more than it actually does. And, when you look at the data and there's previous studies and then there's data in this new study as well that really tries to dig into what difference does this make? So they do these clever kind of strategies where they look at people who are on the wait list but got in versus on the wait list and went somewhere else. And what are the differences that we see in their adult outcomes in the future? And what they find is that so I think two things. First is that it does make a difference in terms of whether you end up in the top 1% of the income distribution, right?
Okay.
But now, let's be clear, very few people, even who go to the Ivy Plus colleges, are getting into that top 1%. It's a minority.
Okay.
But you are more likely to. But because they educate so few people, over 90% of people who are in the top 1% are not from the Ivy Plus, right? So both of those things can be true, right? Most people who get to that income level are not from these elite colleges, but you're more likely to. The same is true for it's more true, but again, it's not like a done deal. Like just because you went to one of these colleges, you're going to get into these positions, or you can't get into them. Our president is a graduate of University of Delaware, so he and Syracuse Law School, right? And so but in politics, it's a lot more. If you look at the Supreme Court,
I was just going to say the Supreme Court is made up heavily of Ivy League grads.
Yeah, but that's 8 people, right? And so it's not. Most people are not on the Supreme Court or the President of the United States, but So the Senate versus the House of Representatives, much more diverse. But even the Senate, it's 25%.
Right.
And so most people, so I think we have to sort of keep that in mind. It's not a deal breaker. Of course, you can have a very good life. Most people in this country don't go to these colleges educate less than 1% of young people. And a lot of young people are doing really well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. We are talking about the role of family wealth in college admissions with Natasha Wari-Ku, a sociologist at Tufts University. We have time for about one more question for you. And, I want to pick back up on a point you made about legacy admissions and kind of their maybe fading away. Maybe, we're seeing Harvard's legacy admissions being challenged, but also seeing in the news Wesleyan College in Connecticut, which had a 17% acceptance rate this year, it just announced that it was doing away with legacy admissions. So is this the shape of things to come? Step in the right direction? What do you make of that?
I absolutely think it's a step in the right direction, but I think we are in this moment with the student loan crisis, with the end of race-conscious admissions, where colleges are really rethinking, let's put it all on the table. Let's really, and I hope that colleges are really trying to think more broadly about what are we trying to do? What is our goal, our mission? And how do we admit students in a way that furthers our mission? So let's stop trying to look at what do they do in the past and look at, what do we think they're going to do in the future? How are they going to shape our shared society? Now, of course, your academic credentials, your leadership, all of those things are predictive of what you might do in the future. But let's focus on the future and not, you know, did you get a certain SAT score?
Well, super quick follow-up that it's kind of like a challenge that I've heard to this argument about doing away with legacy admissions is, what if you are might be from an underrepresented community at an elite college and you got in and you're like, okay, finally, this is like a ticket to get my family onto a different wealth track, you know, now that I was in. And, you know, I have heard of people who are in that situation who are like, what? That was my hard work to get there. Like, what do you make of that kind of argument?
I hear that. And, you know, when I did my research for my book, The Diversity Bargain, students said that. Well, you know, underrepresented minority students said, well, you know, yeah, I want to pass that on to my future children. But I think the reality is that it's something that reproduces inequality. And so 70% of legacy admits, according to this study in the Ivy Plus, are white. And so it's always going to be a policy that perpetuates because it's looking at the previous generation. And if we're getting more and more inclusive, then by looking at the previous generation, you're sort of limiting. And so I would say that that person can still guide their siblings, their children in a way that those young people are going to benefit as well and do just fine without that legacy benefit.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We're talking about the role of family wealth in college admissions. Natasha Wariku joined us to talk about that. She's a sociologist at Tufts University. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.